This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 117 was recorded on May 10th, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. GavCal founder Charles Gav will be joining me as this week's feature interview guest. Charles is a true elder statesman of the finance industry, with over 40 years' experience in the industry, including more than three solid decades as a widely respected money manager. Now, of course, we're going to cover the usual hit list of macro topics, but I'm particularly keen to ask Charles about his experience working in the industry in the very early 1970s, the last time that secular inflation hit the global economy. Specifically, I want to ask Charles how well prepared he thinks today's finance industry is to handle a return to secular inflation, something that more and more top analysts see on the horizon, and frankly, with something which most professionals in finance have never actually dealt with in their careers. Sooner or later, inflation will be back. I think you'll be quite interested to hear Charles' opinion on how well prepared the professional finance industry is for that inevitable event. Be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick and I will be back for extended equity market coverage discussing the upside breakout from the triangle pattern that exists in the S&P 500, and also extended coverage on the crude oil market.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500 is now pushing the 2720 level on the upper end, definitively breaking out that triangle that you referenced to the upside. Is this rally for real? Is this the real breakout that we were talking about over the last couple of weeks?
Well, you know, this is exactly what we told listeners to watch for in last week's commentary and in prior weeks before that. I thought we were likely to see another leg to the downside, but I said, watch that trend line at the top of this triangle. If we see an upside breakout through the trend line, and especially if it starts to gain momentum above that level, and if it gains volume above that level, that could mean that this market correction, which frankly has been a little bit long in the tooth in terms of the number of weeks that it's been persisting, might actually be over with a resolution back towards new all-time highs. The thing though, Patrick, you know, for our listeners who are old enough to remember the 1980s, there was an old hamburger commercial for Wendy's Hamburgers, and there was this little old lady who used to say, "Where's the beef?" And the one thing I see missing in today's action, as impressive as the price action was to the upside, I don't see the volume. So I'm asking, where's the volume? This is something we got to go into more detail on. Let's save the rest of the discussion for our post-game segment where we can pull some charts up and really take a deep dive into what's going on in the equity market.
All right, well, let's move on to the U.S. dollar index, which after rallying almost as high as 93.50, finally took a breather on that inflation print. What's your thinking here on the dollar?
Well, you know, the way I see this, Patrick, the move to the upside is accelerating. It looks very, very strong and very bullish to me. We were way overdue for a pullback. I've lost count of how many up days in a row. So the fact that we're taking a little bit breather here, you know, as you say, there was an inflation print that was an excuse for the market to take a long overdue pause to catch its breath again. I don't think there's any reason from my perspective to see that it's, you know, going to be over at this point or reverse to the downside, dollar's going to crash, any of that. Now, in the very long term, I still think that if I think about, well, what about the bear arguments? The Luke Groman bear argument, the one that says eventually the U.S. dollar is going to lose its hegemony over the global financial system and just kind of fade away from its prior importance, there's still no doubt in my mind that Luke Groman is going to be proven right in the end. The question is, when is the end, and are we there yet? And I don't think that we are. So I don't see any reason to take something like Luke Groman's view and make that bring question to my mind about the strength of this immediate short-term rally that we've seen. What does scare me, though, is Juliet de Klerk's bear view, because I spoke to Juliet again this week, said, "Juliet, you still on the bear case on the dollar? Do you still think?" She said, "Absolutely, Eric. I've told my subscribers to get out of the way of this thing. cover their shorts for tactical reasons because there may be some more upside here, but it's an opportunity to get short with better location. Quite frankly, I don't understand why Juliet thinks that, because all the indications that I see are bullish. The thing is, Juliet's track record is pretty darn spectacular, and unlike Luke Grohman, who has a very long-term macro view, Juliet is a much more tactical, short-term, what's going to happen in the market in the next few weeks kind of analyst. She's got an incredibly impressive track record, and she's saying this is an opportunity to get short. I don't understand it, and we've got her booked for next week, so we'll find out next week why Juliet is so bearish on the U.S. dollar.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because this rally in oil just continues this week, and with crude oil prices almost touching the 72 mark on the upside. What's driving this move relentlessly higher?
Well, no doubt about it. President Trump's decision to pull the United States out of the Iran nuclear deal and reimpose sanctions pretty much overwhelms everything else. You know, fundamentals and inventory and so forth fades into the background when you have something of that importance. Now, the thing is, everybody's been waiting for this. We thought we had until May 12th, which was the deadline. President Trump actually made the announcement on Tuesday, so several days early. The thing is, the outcome of the United States pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, which of course is what was announced, that was really already priced into the market. Just about everybody expected that to happen. So that got us up to the prices that we were at. Why did they move even higher after that? Well, one day later, you know, the market may have priced in the United States pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, but it wasn't pricing in an escalation from there into a military conflict. One day after this announcement, we got missiles flying between Iran and Israel. And of course, they're each telling different stories. Israel says it was attacked by Iran and acted in self-defense. Iran is claiming that Israel staged some sort of false flag event. You know, who knows who's telling the true story there? The point is, we've already got military escalation less than 24 hours after President Trump announces this. People are really starting to wonder now, okay, where is it headed from here? Now, without a doubt, if we get an escalation to a full-on, you know, Middle Eastern war, anything is possible, including $100 plus oil prices. The thing is, Patrick, what's more likely, quite frankly, in a situation like this, everybody's wound up, everybody is so worried about what this could escalate into. If it turns out that the bullish news has already been priced in and, you know, we don't have a further military escalation, if things settle down, I think that there is definitely all the ingredients in place for, at minimum, a significant pullback in oil prices. We've gotten just so pushed up so high so quickly, and it's mostly on these geopolitical escalation fears. Now, if those fears prove true and, you know, war breaks out, anything can happen. But if we see a de-escalation geopolitically, I think we're overdue for at least some kind of downside correction.
So how did the inventory numbers come out this week, Eric?
Well, Patrick, I think that's actually part of what fueled the market rally higher even after President Trump's announcement. For the last couple of weeks, we had fairly bearish inventory reports. This time we got a drawdown, a bullish report. Crude oil drawing down 2.2 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma, on the other hand, building 1.4 million barrels. And it's very important to understand that that potential crisis we saw where Cushing was really drawing down its storage, and Cushing is very critical because it's the source of the heavy oil blend stock that we need in order to mix with all of the oil coming out of the shale patch. That situation is still correcting itself. But gasoline and distillates both drawing down. Gasoline down 2.2 million barrels, distillates down 3.8 million barrels. So that all is, with the exception of Cushing, fairly bullish news. And of course, coming on the back of President Trump's announcement, and then right afterwards, we saw the missiles flying. You know, all these things are pushing the price much higher. That's how we got almost to $72. Frankly, I won't be surprised if we get to 73 or 74 before this hysteria fades away. But there's also some very bearish news here. Nobody seems to be paying attention to it, but production was up another 84,000 barrels this week to another record of 10.7 million barrels. Now remember, 20,000 barrels per week annualizes to 1 million barrels per year. So 84,000 barrels this week. That annualizes to more than 4 million barrels per day of additional production on an annualized basis if that were sustained every single week. Exports, meanwhile, really holding up there at 1.9 million barrels per day. That works out to about 13.1 million barrels on the week that was exported and would have otherwise been added to inventory. Meanwhile, we've got this dollar breakout, although, as you said, it's taking a pause today. We've seen very good strength in the dollar for the last few weeks. That should be bearish for oil. And also keep in mind that the last two inventory reports were quite bearish for oil, but they were ignored completely because the market was so focused on what was President Trump going to do about the Iran nuclear deal. So the market has been ignoring a lot of bearish news, and I think it's going to continue to ignore the bearish news until we see some kind of de-escalation of these military conflicts that are going on between Iran, Syria, and Israel. Again, anything is possible if a war breaks out, but if it doesn't, I think we've got a pretty significant pullback. And if that pullback were to be coupled, let's say, with some bearish news, you know, maybe we have next week's inventory report is a bearish surprise, you've got the potential of triggering an unwind of that massively lopsided speculative long position that exists in all of the energy products, whether it be Brent or WTI or finished products.
Now, Eric, that all makes complete sense to me, but what I'm a little confused at, and maybe you can add some clarification to this, is that how does the fact that there's potentially new sanctions being reimposed on Iran, how does this impact the oil markets, and what will be the effect when this is entailed?
Well, you know, this is something that I think a lot of Americans are not really getting the full perspective on because of the way that it's being presented. What they've said is, okay, we've reimposed the sanctions. Now, what really is not mentioned very much in the U.S. news coverage is the United States doesn't really have any significant financial relationships with Iran to start with. So there's nothing to sanction or to change. What these sanctions apply to is they are going to penalize multinational companies, including a lot of European companies that are doing business with Iran. Now, you know, the American viewpoint here is, well, this is, you know, America's job or responsibility or something is to, you know, do good in the world and put Iran in its place and make sure that we, you know, don't tolerate this nuclear situation. Put yourself in the shoes of the employee of a European company who just got laid off because his company was doing business with Iran with the full and complete blessings of his government. It's completely, totally legal in France to do what they're doing. The Frenchman who just got laid off from his job probably doesn't share that American view that it's the United States' job to tell Iran what to do. He probably sees it as bullying. So the viewpoint outside the United States about these sanctions is very different, because what they're sanctioning is multinational companies, mostly European companies, Volkswagen, Total, you know, a whole bunch of companies that do business with Iran legally, and whose national governments entirely support continuing to do so. And the U.S. government has taken it upon itself to financially punish those companies if they continue to do something which is legal, and it may lead to loss of employment in those countries. My point here, regardless of whether you think the United States is doing the right thing or the wrong thing, is it's contentious. The ingredients are here for a lot of people to get pissed off and for there to be political escalations. You know, these are the kind of things that lead to military conflict. So I think it's important to understand that there's a lot of angst in the system about whether or not it's appropriate for the United States to be doing this, and a lot of people outside the United States don't think it is.
All right, well, what's the bottom line then? Are you bullish or bearish here at crude oil? I know we're going to look at some charts in the post game, but what's your thinking?
Well, my thinking is that anything is possible to the upside if this escalates further. If you get an outright war, you know, Israel drops a nuclear bomb on Iran, then, you know, you could have $100 prices tomorrow. The thing is, I don't think that's likely to happen. The more probable situation is that this boils over and settles down. And, you know, I think probably we've got more upside in this market. I want to talk to you in postgame, and I know you've been working with your subscribers at Big Picture Trading using measured moves and other techniques to try to figure out where the top might be in this market. I don't think we're there yet. I want to get your view on whether or not we're at the top. I think it's got further to go to the upside. The thing is, if the geopolitical situation stabilizes, which I think is more likely than all-out war or something like that, then there's really a strong set of bearish fundamentals that have been ignored by the market for a long time, and I think that there is potentially a very significant unwind. Remember, though, we've got the OPEC meeting coming up in June. Now, I frankly think that the actual real-world effect of that meeting and whatever decision is made there on real-world supply and demand dynamics is exactly zero. I think that this is all about propaganda and perception management. But frankly, it's very effective propaganda and perception management. They're probably going to continue to jawbone the market higher. And one thing that seems to have become clear in the last couple of weeks, you know, we thought for a while that Saudi Arabia didn't want to allow prices to get as high as $80 because they were concerned about that enabling further growth of the U.S. shale patch. Well, it seems like Saudi Arabia's messaging for the last week or two has made it pretty darn clear they've got no problem with $80 oil. And I think that is a change of stance. But Patrick, as much as all of these things, you know, paint a picture of maybe setting up further jawboning, a further move up to, I don't know, $75 on WTI, $80 on Brent, wouldn't surprise me at all. Don't lose sight of the restart of the U.S. shale revolution. 85,000 barrels this week alone in additional production. Again, that annualizes to 4 million barrels a year of production growth if it's sustained. And we've seen for the last several weeks, it hasn't been quite 85 every week, but, you know, 35 one week, 65 the next week, 85 this week. We're expecting at least another 2 to 3 million barrels, maybe as much as 4 million barrels of additional U.S. production. These are very bearish fundamental signals that have been ignored so far. At some point, that's going to kick in and we're going to see a big pullback, but I don't think it's time yet.
Well, Eric, let's get back to that post game because we can pull up some charts and kind of look at the levels on oil. But for now, let's move on to gold, where we were testing that 1300 level or just hovering right above a 1300. And now that inflation number that kind of turned the US dollar gave gold a pop. We're trading around this 1322 level. Do you think we head right back toward the previous highs around 1350?
You know, I don't know what to make of gold. I was watching 1308 as the support level, and we did trade below that several times, didn't really say sustained below it. I don't see any daily closes below the 1308. Maybe we had one back on May 2nd. But, you know, Patrick, we didn't get a strong rejection and a massive rally either. We saw some strength today, 1321, as we're coming into the close on Thursday afternoon. Is it headed back higher? I'm not sure. I think the dollar probably still has considerable more upside. That should mean more downside for gold. Again, I'm humbled. I hate to ever risk fading what Juliet de Klerk says in terms of tactical calls because her track record is so good. We'll get Juliet's opposite view on the dollar next week. Meanwhile, my view on gold is wait and see. I was expecting maybe a little bit more weakness that we haven't seen, so it's been resilient, but I don't see a lot of strength either.
All right, well, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yield because we were teasing on that 3% level again, and obviously a little bit of a breather today. We're trading around 296 here. What's your thinking here on the yields?
Well, it's really unchanged from last week. You know, the number to watch, the number to care about as far as a technical resistance level is not 3%. It's 3.05. And we got within a couple of basis points of that a couple of weeks ago. We pulled back from it. It's doing what it's supposed to do. It's acting as resistance. I think that if we saw a couple of daily candles above that level, that would certainly say something. Now we've got the breakout. We haven't seen that. And at this point, you know, it's more likely to edge away from that. I do think that the setup exists for a short squeeze. I'm kind of surprised that we haven't seen one with so much lopsided positioning. We didn't get the breakout when it rejected 305 and moved 10 basis points back to the downside in yield. I thought maybe a short squeeze was starting, but then it edged back up again. So I don't know. I'm watching it, but I don't think you can make any call that says, hey, you know, the bear market is on until you see a break past that critical level at 3.05.
Well, thanks for the summary, Eric. Now, GavCal founder Charles Gav is this week's featured interview guest. Eric's interview with Charles is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is GavCal partner and founder, Charles Gav. Charles, thanks so much for joining us on the program. You penned an article recently. You know, so many people look at the yield curve as a sign of oncoming recessions, but most people only bother to look at the yield curve on government debt, on treasury debt. You've recently observed that the corporate yield curve is sending a very different message than government yield curve. Please elaborate. Tell us what that was about and give us a sense of what that signals in terms of your expectations for market conditions as a result of what you're seeing.
Okay, let's start with, I think, something that probably all your listeners agree. And it's a very simple one, is that the government is not responsible for the growth in the economy. I think most people would agree with that. So if the government is not responsible for the growth in the economy, then why is the yield curve, which is basically the cost of short-term money from the government, which you subtract from the cost of long-term money for the government? And it's, there is no reason why it should work, because the government can always borrow on top of that. There is no yield curve, but the government cannot borrow. So the answer is they've done a lot of work on Swedish economist called Wicksell. Wicksell lived at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th. He had a massive influence on the Austrians and on Thomas Fischer, on Fischer and so on in the US. And he had a brilliant idea. He said the economic cycle is created by the presence in the economy of two interest rates. And let's put it simply, the rate at which you can borrow and the rate at which you can invest. And said, Wicksell, in order not to have too big an economic cycle or financial cycle, the two should be on each other most of the time. Because if the cost of capital is way above the return on invested capital, then it pays to repay the debt, and we move into what specialists call a debt deflation, which means that's what you had in the 30s, that's what Japan had for decades, and it doesn't work. On the other hand, if the rates are too low, then it pays to buy existing assets on by borrowing money. You borrow at 2 to buy an asset yielding 4. The price of these assets eventually go up, but nobody invests in new assets because it entails a risk. And what it leads to at the end is that the rich get richer, the debt gets bigger, the price of asset goes higher. And what happens is that the poor are getting poorer. Since nobody is investing into capital spending, the productivity goes down. And the poor guys, the only way for them to have a higher standard of living is capital spending for them to have a higher productivity. Otherwise, they can't. So what Wicksell is saying, something quite brilliant, he says, look, trying to create growth by maintaining short-term interest rates too low always ends badly. You never know when. It always ends badly because it leads to accumulation of debt, inflated asset prices, and eventually the cost of money starts going up because everybody has been borrowing. So return on invested capital starts going down. And we always end in a period where the cost of money moves above the cost of capital and you have a debt deflation. So says Wicksell, be careful, guys. Don't manipulate short-term rates lower because it always ends badly. So it's a Keynes uses a lot of the Wicksell's work too, but it's almost a perfect condemnation of Keynes' theories. That's the so that's the first idea. And what I'm trying to say is that the classical yield curve works in the U.S. for a very simple reason. It's because short rates on governments are a proxy for the cost of capital. Long rates are a proxy for the long-term return on invested capital. And so if the curve inverts, it means that the cost of capital is above the return on capital, and then all hell breaks loose. It cannot not lead to a recession. But what I'm saying, it's a better idea to do it with the cost of capital for the private sector and the return on invested capital for the private sector, also rather than do it with the government sector. That's all I'm trying to say.
Charles, what conclusions do you draw from what you're seeing in the corporate yield curve, and what does it tell you about what might be ahead for the equity market?
Okay, we are right now at a point where, believe it or not, private sector yield curve, as I computed, is literally at zero, totally flat, which usually, if it stays there, It's going to be uncomfortable, but we probably can survive. But if suddenly it starts inverting with short rates going up, which we can do perhaps starting in June at the next meeting of the Fed, then every time when the private sector yield curve inverted in the past, we had a big problem, financial economic problem, either in the U.S. or outside of the U.S. Outside of the U.S., it occurred if somebody had a fixed exchange rate system with the U.S., for example, like Mexico in 1994, when the private sector yield curve inverted. Not much happened in the U.S. economy, but Mexico went bust. And then it inverted again in 1997, and the fixed exchange rate between the Asian currencies and the dollar at the time. Not much happened in the U.S. economy, but Asia went bust. And in 1999, it inverted again, and this time we had a recession in the U.S. because it matters, this one matters for the U.S. economy. So what I'm trying to say is that the U.S. being the reserve currency of the world, it's a difficult question because if you have countries that have a fixed exchange rate system with the U.S. dollar, you won't have that many left, but you still have a few, they could be hurting badly if right now, for example, their currency is overvalued and the yield curve in the U.S. inverts, which means that the rate of return on invested capital in this country is going to plummet. So what I'm trying to say is that up to very recently, you could say, to put it bluntly, you have two kind of bear markets in financial markets. You have so 10 to 12% bear market, 10 to 15, which is a pause that refreshes to a certain extent. There is not much to be afraid of. And there is what I call the big bad bear market, like a grizzly, a huge bear. And that occurs every 20, 30 years. Huh? We have had two or three recently. So what I'm saying is I can probably tell you that the probability of a downside movement of the market is pretty high, especially if short rates keep going up in the U.S. today. I have no way of telling you whether it's going to be a minus 10 or a minus 50, if you see what I mean. That's clear. But the probability of a minus 10 is getting bigger by the day.
You mentioned that countries which have currencies tied to the U.S. dollar, as Mexico had back in the 90s, are potentially at risk. I know you have offices in Hong Kong. The Hong Kong Monetary Authority has been having difficulty maintaining the peg of the Hong Kong dollar. It seems that the carry trade has been so attractive that a lot of money is flowing out of Hong Kong, carry trading into U.S. treasuries. Have you looked at that situation, and is that an indication of this same phenomenon, or is it related?
It is related, absolutely. And the big question for Hong Kong, I mean, it's not a question there, because it's not the first time that it occurs. They have had a currency board for since the middle of the 80s, so it goes back a long way. So the currency board, which is a fixed exchange rate, implies that if suddenly it's more interesting for the guys in Hong Kong to invest in the U.S. and in Hong Kong, what happens then is that the money flows out of Hong Kong, normally, and then the money supply in Hong Kong starts shrinking. And usually what it leads to is some kind of a big fall in asset prices in Hong Kong. The mechanism of adjustment for Hong Kong has never been a difference in interest rates with the U.S., which they cannot really have. It has been the volatility of the asset prices. And most of the asset prices in Hong Kong are either the stock market, which is big but not that big, but real estate. So in the last 20 years, you had two or three crashes in Hong Kong in real estate, which always took place when the private sector in the U.S., the private sector yield curve inverted. So while I'm very bullish on Hong Kong long term, I would not be buying real estate in Hong Kong right now, if you see what I mean. I would be waiting patiently.
Do you think that there's any risk that the Hong Kong Monetary Authority will lose that peg and be unable to maintain the peg, or is that something where they have plenty of money?
No, that's impossible for a very simple reason. That the central bank reserves of the Hong Kong Monetary Authority are bigger than the U.S. money, than the money supply in Hong Kong. So basically what it means is that they can buy back all the Hong Kong dollars if they want, and then that's it. So no, they cannot lose it.
Okay, so there's no real risk to the Hong Kong dollar, although it has been riding its lower limit of its peg.
It's almost impossible. No, there is a risk on asset prices in Hong Kong, but there is no risk on the peg being broken.
So are you more bearish then on the Hang Seng than you are on the S&P because of this condition?
Yeah, a lot of things happening in Asia. And here, I would be very careful. I've written quite a lot about it too recently. China, for the last, 10 years, at least since the big financial crisis, has been trying to de-dollarize Asia. they are going everywhere, offering swaps to every central bank, telling them, look, we will accept your country currency for settlement with us, we will accept yours. They basically have created a kind of new IMF in Shanghai, a new World Bank in Beijing. So China wants to de-dollarize Asia. And what they are doing is that they are simply almost underwriting the current account deficits of Indonesia or what have you, of all these countries. So you have to understand something very important. When the U.S. did that with the Marshall Plan in the 50s, what happened is that long interest rates in Germany at that time were at 7%. Long interest rates in the U.S. were at 2%. With a risk on Germany being underwritten by the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank and the U.S. government at the time, the two interest rates converged. And the same thing is going to happen in Asia. So what's going to happen is that, let's say, Russian interest rates are at 8%. Indonesian interest rates are around 7 or 8. Indian interest rates are at 7 or 8. They will all converge in the next 10 years towards the 4% that China is paying. So we are going to have the model of old bond market in Asia with interest rates halving. And when interest rates halve, usually long-dated bonds in local currencies go through the roof. It goes without saying. And the second thing that happens is that real estate goes through the roof. And the third thing that happens is that growth stocks go through the roof. So what I'm trying to tell our clients is, given the fact that China is now stabilizing Asia with an immense balance sheet, the least dangerous part of the world is today in Asia. Europe is extremely dangerous because the monetary system in Europe is not viable. And the U.S. have a basic contradiction occurring right now between the monetary policy and the budget policy. It's not going to work. So what I'm trying to tell to all our readers is, fellows, the only place where you should have bonds is in Asia, because these bonds are going to go up and their currencies are going to go up. Our central banks in Europe and the U.S. want and tell you clearly their exchange rate to go down. These countries, with China, they want their currencies to go up. So, and they serve you a real interest rate of 8 or 9 or 7%. So where in the world do you find interest rates on government bonds at 7% in a currency which is going to go up? This is an anomaly.
Now, I suppose that the counterargument would be a lot of people have said, look at the size of China's credit expansion. They are at risk of potentially having a credit crisis as big as the United States had in 2008 and 2009. Where does that fit into this equation?
Basically, it's a very simple answer. You see, credit crisis occur if one or two things happen. The first one, if the banks borrow short-term money from the financial system or what have you, and use these borrowings to buy assets with a different duration than the money that they borrowed. So basically, they borrow short-term and they invest long-term. When we had the big crisis in 2008, the money center banks in the U.S. had borrowed something like 3 times their capital to do transformation in the housing market and what have you. So the first reason why banks go bust is they make a big mistake in the duration between what they borrow and what they invest in. Okay? Then they are very sensitive to a liquidity crisis. The second thing that can happen is that if a central bank buys in a foreign currency, like Thailand in 1997, if you borrow in a foreign currency, then you're screwed if suddenly the foreign currency starts going up and you can't repay or your currency goes down. When you look at the Chinese debt, it's all the loans in China, all are financed by deposits, which is the safest form of long-term financing. And moreover, there is absolutely no borrowing from China in any other currency. So what I'm trying to tell to impress on our readers is, fellows, stop thinking about debt the way you do. The only thing which matters in a debt is if you have a debt to a foreigner. China owes 100% of its money to domestic citizens in China. So on a consolidated basis, there is no debt in China. France has a debt because 70% of its government debt is owned by foreigners. 0% of the Chinese debt is owned by foreigners. So it's basically one part of the government lending money to a second part of the government with a guarantee of a third part of the government. China is not going to go bankrupt. Let me give you an example of Japan. The Japanese Central Bank has been buying 50% of the Japanese government debt. Fine. And they have been buying that debt at 0 interest rates while the debt was issued at 102. So basically, they buy at 110, repayable at 100. So everybody's happy because they receive 110 instead of having 100. So they're very happy. Second thing that happens that let's assume that China, that Japan now buys the remaining 50%. Now, all the debt is owned by the Japanese central bank. What does it mean? Well, it means that then they can merge the treasury and the central bank and cancel the debt. They have replaced the government bonds 10-year zero by a perpetual zero coupon bond at zero interest rate, which is called a banknote. So what I'm trying to say is that people have been losing money in the Japanese bond market, shorting it for the last 15 years, without understanding that since the debt was owned by the Japanese, there was no debt. It's absolutely extraordinary. If I owe money to my son, the family has no debt consolidated. This is ridiculous. So when you talk about debt, you have two kinds of debt. The debt that can kill you if you borrow money from the foreigners and or if you have the wrong durations. But when you look at yourself, you can't have a banking crisis in a country that has massive excess savings. Makes no sense. So this is one of the most ridiculous things, and I think it's probably tied to the Germans' way of thinking, which because debt and guilt are the same word in German. So debt is bad. Debt is neither good nor bad. Debt is a tool. It's like a hammer. A hammer is neither good nor bad. It's just a hammer. And the debt is just a debt. What matters is who borrows, when, at what duration, and what with it. And if everybody borrows from his neighbor, there is no debt.
We've been discussing the yield curve. Let's come back to the underlying interest rate itself. A lot of people are starting to say, look, the 35-year bond bull market is over, and we're coming up on a key level at about 3.05 on the U.S. 10-year. A number of experts have said that's the technical level. If we break that, it's all over. It's a big sell-off. And some people have even said that both stocks and bonds selling off at the same time could force a big unwind of the massive risk parity trade that so many institutions have on in the markets. Do you agree with that view that we are potentially on the cusp of bond markets selling off dramatically and higher yields? And if so, do you agree with the risk to risk parity?
Yes, I do agree on both, because the risk parity is just taking advantage of something that has worked for the last 30 years or so, which was you had a negative correlation between the bond and the stock market. If the stock market was going down, the bond market was going up, and if the bond market was going up, going down, the stock market was going up. See what I mean? It's what happened when you have a deflationary period. It's always the same thing. Let's assume that this is over, that we are moving into an inflationary period, which is a possibility. Then, if you want to build a portfolio for an inflationary period, having bonds, for God's sake, is the stupidest idea that you can have. Because you're going to be destroyed with inflation going up. So the idea of hedging an equity position with a bond position works only if we are in a zero or deflationary period. It doesn't work if we are putting it on inflationary period. The problem is that since it has worked for the last 30 years, every computer now in the world is programmed to buy this portfolio with 50% interest, 50% in bonds, and you beat the hell out of every index over the last 30 years. So my fear is that we may have massive positions that are managed by idiots. By that I mean computers. And there is nothing more dangerous. As we saw in 1987, the computers got crazy suddenly, and we had a 27% decline in one day. You see, computers compute very fast, but they're idiots.
I definitely want to come back to this subject of inflation as a secular trend. But before we go there, you wrote a piece recently called The Upcoming Monetary War with Gold as an Arbiter. Please give us an overview. What do you see in terms of what's coming, and how does gold play into the story?
Okay. You are China. You want to de-dollarize the world. Okay. So you have to offer a credible alternative to the dollar. You want to de-dollarize not only trade between nations in Asia. If Korea was selling goods to Taiwan, they were settling their accounts up to 2 or 3 years ago in dollar. And the Chinese are saying, why on earth do we have to use a dollar to settle the account between us? So they are trying to do that. They're also trying to de-dollarize the oil markets. It has started with Russia. Iran is now selling its oil in euro. So you have a lot of movements saying that there is something happening also in the oil market. If you can simply now put your oil in your own currency, it's a total and colossal change for the world. So The Chinese want to de-dollarize, but now the problem is that they want also to keep their capital account closed. In simple words, that means that they want to control the money that comes in and out of China. So it's difficult to tell people you should keep your reserves in renminbi if at the same time you prevent the guys from either investing in China or taking the money from abroad, you see what I mean, whatever they had. So the very astute solution that the Chinese have found has been to tell the guys, look, if you have too many renminbis, because they've been selling a lot of oil to China or whatever, we will settle either in renminbi, you can keep the renminbis in your reserve, fine with us, or we can give you gold instead of the renminbi. So you have to understand that the gold price is now a big play between the U.S. and China. For the Chinese currency to be credible, a big rise in the price of gold would help them tremendously because they have been buying gold like crazy for the last 6 or 7 years. So they have huge inventories of gold. And that would immediately allow to give them a lot of credibility to their currency. On the other hand, the Americans don't want that de-dollarization because that's part of their power. And so what they are trying to do is prevent gold from going up. So to a certain extent, the price of gold is going to tell you who is going to win in that effort to de-dollarize Asia. If gold goes up, it's China. If gold goes down, it's the U.S.
And do you have a favorite for who you think is likely to win? And because obviously you could argue that this is either a gold bullish or a gold bearish case, depending on who you think is going to win the war.
Basically, what I do is I never make a forecast because if anybody could make a forecast, socialism would work. And we all know it doesn't. So I'm just trying to analyze the things where they should be and then look at the inflection point. So what I've found, for example, if you compare the total return of the gold price, an ounce of gold, to the total return of a long-dated U.S. euro government bond over 5 years, well, if gold outperforms the long bond market, it means that people are starting to be worried about the U.S. dollar. They would rather own gold rather than a bond giving them a yield and so on. So every time when gold outperformed basically a long-dated government bond in the U.S., over 5 years on a moving average, then it means that inflation is coming back, and it means also that the Chinese are winning. If gold underperforms the long-dated bond, then it's the other way around. So let's try to think that one through. What I'm telling my clients is you do simply a simple chart. You look at whatever long-term government bond index you're following. You divide gold by that index. If it is above its moving average, fine. You buy gold. If it is below, you stay with your bonds. The big problem is, believe it or not, for the last 6 months, the DAM ratio has been exactly on its moving average. It cannot make up its mind. It's extraordinary. It stays there. There is a kind of stalemate. So I look at the stalemate and I wait to see which way it's going to break. I'm not going to make an indicator attempt. If it moves, I will follow. If it doesn't move, I will stay put.
You made some comments about inflation a moment ago. I'd like to come back to that because it's way beyond my pay grade to guess whether or not right now is the time that we're going to see a return to secular inflation. But I know it's coming someday. And it seems to me like in a case like this, if something is coming, who you need to talk to is the guy that was there last time. But for something like a return of secular inflation, we're talking people that are working in the industry now that were also working in the industry in 1971 when this began last time. There's only about a dozen of you guys left, Charles. That scares me. I don't think many people know what to do when inflation starts. Am I correct to worry about that? And what would you tell people since you were there?
Absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. So I will give you the results. I've published some research on that. All the youngsters that don't have the benefit of being as old as I am, these are the results. First, when you have in period of zero or negative inflation, long bonds diversify an equity position extremely well. When inflation starts going up, bonds lose all their diversification power. They become positively correlated with the equities and with a lower return and a higher volatility. So basically owning bonds, if we enter into an inflationary period, you have to be totally stupid. So the first thing is that 50% of your portfolios is probably now in bonds. this is the part that you should be looking at very clearly, very carefully. You see, I mean, this is a very important stuff. The second thing which I've checked in the 60s and the 70s in the U.S. is that the bond market in the U.S. was a disaster. But you had some countries out there that were fighting inflation reasonably. And that was, for example, Germany. So if instead of having to hedge your equity position in the U.S., the U.S. bond market, which proved to be a disaster, if you had bought German bonds, you did very well. So you can protect against a coming inflationary period by using the bond market of a non-inflationary country. In the 70s, it was Germany or Switzerland. And my guess is at this time, it could be once again China. So maybe the name of the game, if you enter into an inflationary period, is replace to hedge your equity position in the U.S., which you should keep, the U.S. bond market by the Chinese bond market. Or by So that's the very important point, because it keeps a non-inflationary bond market keeps its diversifying power. An inflationary power, an inflationary bond market doesn't for equities. So the answer to your question is it is a lot more difficult to manage money in an inflationary period than in the disinflationary period. Managing money in disinflationary period basically is a piece of cake, because you always have a tailwind. You see what I mean? Interest rates falling, and that bails you out every time. If you go into inflation, you have to be very careful. And the second thing that happened in every inflationary period that I've studied is that value starts to outperform growth every time. Because value is a short duration asset, growth is a long duration asset in equities, and long duration assets are killed when you move into an inflationary period. In every inflationary period, the Shiller P ratio lose roughly 5% a year as long as prices are accelerating, or 1 or 2 points of the Shiller P ratio. So what I'm trying to say is that first, you are not going to be helped by rising PE. Second, you're going to have a tough time because value will be better than growth, and nobody owns any value stock anymore. And third, you will have to get the hell out of the U.S. bond market if you want to get some kind of a hedge. So managing money in an inflationary period is hell.
And the people that are working in the industry, other than yourself and a small handful of people that are old enough to remember the early 70s, seems to me like it's a setup here for a whole industry full of professionals who really have no idea, have no experience whatsoever. Inflation is something they read about in a textbook in college and forgot about ever since. How did this go in the early 70s? Were people caught off guard? Did it take them a couple of years to kind of figure it out and learn how to manage money in that environment? And what can people expect in coming years?
A couple of years, it took them 10 years. Yeah, I remember vividly, I was in a French bank called the Banque de Suez at the time. And it was in 71. The bond market, basically the dollar has just started to float freely in August 71. It's on capital increase gold, so suddenly currencies were floating. Inflation was picking up massively. And the investment committees in my bank at the time, it was the beginning of my career, were a riot. Nobody had a clue. Because they had been managed on the fixed interest rate system with low inflation for the last 40 years. 40 years. So that's why I created my first research firm at the time, in 1973, called Cybergest, and I sold a lot of that research in the U.S. too, because absolutely nobody had any clue. So you had a very volatile market, up, down, sideways, and it was difficult to be amused, if you see what I mean. It was a tough period. So the same thing could happen. The big news is, however, that Asia around China could play the role that Germany played in the 70s at the time, to help you find a solution. When I was managing money in the funds that I built a few years ago, I was managing around $10 billion. Every time I didn't know what to do with my portfolios, I bought some bonds, because to a large extent, I believed that the Bundesbank was going to be on my side. So by buying bonds, I was going to make money either on the exchange rate or on the capital gain of the bonds or what have you. So to a certain extent, I think the same scenario is happening in Asia around China. So what I'm trying to tell all the young people is, look, guys, I've seen the movie already once with J. Germany in the role of the American cavalry, you see, arriving to the rescue at the end. Maybe I'm going to see it a second time, but this time with China. It's a difficult one, but don't underestimate the difficulty of managing money. And two things happen. Two assets come back that play a role in portfolio construction. The first one is, of course, gold. It's very volatile, but it does play a role. It reduces a little bit the risk in your portfolio. And the second one, believe it or not, is cash. So suddenly, if you are moving into an inflationary period, cash becomes a very attractive asset because interest rates go up and you have no volatility. So in a deflationary period, you play with two assets, bonds and equities. In an inflationary period, you have to play with foreign bonds, local equities, local cash or foreign cash, and gold. So instead of having a world with two assets, you have a world with four assets. And it's not a piece of cake to manage money when you have inflation. It's difficult.
We have a lot of listeners who are in the millennial generation, people in their late 20s and 30s who are working in professional finance. For those who don't want to be caught with their pants down, who want to be ready for this, is there any particular book they should read or other action they should take to get ready so they'll know what to do when secular inflation eventually makes a return?
I've written a few pieces on how to manage money. Books, no. The problem is that, how could I put it? The main issue that we have in the financial world is that now people don't think anymore. They use computers, they build models, and they trust the models, which is a sure way to poverty. So if I had to give them an advice is, okay, maybe you should read von Mises, Hayek, Milton Friedman, Irving Fisher, The Debt Deflation Theory of Great Depression, and so on. And for God's sake, stop thinking. Don't compute. Think. That's what a computer will never do.
Yeah, the computer is still programmed to set you up with that risk parity model that I think a lot of people are correctly concerned is going to break sometime soon.
Absolutely. And it has to, because it has worked for 30 years in a row.
Charles, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. It is just so helpful for our younger listeners to get the wisdom of your many decades in the industry. Before we go, though, GavCal is, of course, an institutional advisory firm. Please tell our institutional listeners where they can learn more about GavCal and the services that you offer there.
Yes. Well, you can go on the GavCal website, and they ask for a password, and then they have access to the research for a few weeks or a few months, and then somebody's going to call them and say, are you interested or not? And then that's about it. I mean, this is the usual. We are not a very aggressive marketing firm. We have 900 clients in the world in 65 different countries, but we are not very good at selling. We are very good at keeping our clients, having a discussion with them. If we are not hard marketers, you see what I mean. The clients come to us because they like us and because we do good work.
And you certainly have an impeccable reputation. So it's GavCal.com for anyone who's interested. It is an institutional advisory firm. Charles, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at MacroVoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Charles. It was such an interesting idea to move away from that government bond yield curve, which is being so distorted by central banks, and looking directly at the private sector yield curve. And as Charles suggested, it is flat and at risk of inverting. Wouldn't it be interesting if it signaled a recession without the traditional yield curve inverting?
Well, Patrick, I agree completely. I think that it surprises me, actually, that Charles is the first person I've seen really focusing on the idea of corporate yield curve. And as you said, you know, if you've got a distorted public yield curve. The private yield curve is the place to look for a more accurate signal. So it's definitely an enlightened approach. The thing that was most interesting to me about this interview was Charles confirmed my greatest fears, which is I don't think the industry is ready for secular inflation. Now, frankly, I think it's beyond my pay grade to guess when that's going to happen. I'm not necessarily, you know, making a prediction that we're about to have a massive return of inflation, but it's coming someday. And when it does, it's very clear to me the finance industry is not ready. As Charles said, the way you think about the most fundamental asset classes is totally different. The role that cash plays in a portfolio is totally different. You've got to think about gold. You've got to think about inflation hedges. And you've got an entire industry now, which, you know, they read about inflation as a concept in a textbook. Most finance professionals barely remember it when they were little kids in the 1970s. And I think that we are in for trouble when the industry doesn't know what to do. And I think it's not only understanding inflation, but it's, you know, there's a book a few years ago called Trade the Trader, which is about understanding what other traders are going to do. And I think you've really got to think about what is going to happen when we get a return of secular inflation and nobody knows what to do because they never in their career have dealt with it before, and it's something they just read about in a textbook in college and have no experience with. The number of guys like Charles that have experience under their belt in a secular inflationary environment, you know, there's only a few dozen of them left in the industry. So I think it's going to be really interesting when we get to that day, whenever it comes. But in any case, Patrick, let's move on to our post-game chart book. Listeners, you'll find the post-game chart book link in your research roundup email. Patrick, you've titled this one, Has the Summer Rally Begun? And, you know, the question I want to ask you as a technician as we get started with this slide deck here is, wow, today's price action, very, very clear upside resolution to the descending triangle pattern that has existed in the S&P. So the first question, it seems to me like the volume wasn't as strong as I would have expected. What do you think about that? But also, what are the other indices doing, and are they confirming the move that we saw in the S&P today?
Well, absolutely. The first comment, and just on volume, I mean, one of the interesting observations I'd make is that lower volume into a summer rally actually would fit the narrative of it, this being a bigger topping formation. I mean, if we had a real high volume breakout, then it could be a full resumption of the bull market. And so, in fact, this sort of fits the narrative quite well. If this entire rally heads right back and retests the previous highs on low volume, it would actually, you know, strengthen my conviction that this is not going to have very much legs past a couple hundred point surge on the S&P. Nonetheless, let's move to a chart on page number two, where we have that daily chart on the S&P 500. And obviously, for the last 3 months, we've been putting that market correction template up, talking about the typical duration of market corrections. And what's really interesting here is that without us having made lower lows in this month of May, then it really does still fit the bill of what a typical market correction would have been, which is it lasts, you know, anywhere from about eight to 12 weeks in total duration. We, you know, pull back somewhere in the 10 to 20% range, often retest a low at least once. In this case, we almost had like a W-shaped kind of double bottom. And now we're having a breakout that is actually demonstrating some technical conviction. What was particularly interesting about this breakout technically is the fact that it came on that weaker inflation print, right? And one of the headwinds that the stock market rally had was that the US dollar was rallying at the same time, which is not the typical thing you would expect from a macro perspective. And so here, when this inflation number came in a little softer than expected, it allowed the US dollar to weaken off its highs. It took a little bit of pressure off of interest rates and the idea that bonds were about to surge or the yields were about to surge above the 3% level. And it, by diffusing that, it really allowed this summer rally narrative to potentially break out. Now, if we go to page number three, where we broke it down to a 4-hour chart, so we can more look at the intraday technical stuff on the charts, we can see that we're actually traded right up to the highs from April, which is right around this kind of 2700 to 2720 area on the upside. Now, this is definitively a breakout of the trend line I've drawn. Some technicians will say I should have connected the March high, and therefore we're only testing the trend line on the upside right now. I mean, that's to the eye of the beholder of how you want to draw it. But to me, this is a key breakout, and I suspect that we're going to rally into the summer. Then one of the things that is relevant to me is that if you look at the CTA industry, the industry of the systematic traders, those traders that make decisions based on software and not necessarily based on intuition, they are using things like 1 month, 3 month, and 6 month momentum measures. And what's particularly interesting about this time frame of May is that the market drops of February have now officially rolled off the data set of 3 month momentum. And that drop we had in March has also officially rolled off of the 1 month momentum measures. And so you suddenly have, you know, addition through subtraction by the fact that those big market drops are now rolling off those momentum indicators, all kind of giving buy signals. So you have a lot of CTA buy signals flashing here. We have breaks of trend lines. The market stopped making lower lows. And if we go from a seasonality perspective into this, we may have a summer rally here. And to me, that's an idea that the S&P can go right back to its previous highs. I don't know whether I'm convinced it's going to go to like 3,000, but you know, a rally back to 2,800 or back to 2,880 doesn't seem unreasonable at this moment.
Okay, now another thing that I know technicians look at a lot is confirmation, not just from the S&P, but from other indices. What are you seeing there?
Well, this is what I wanted to point out with charts number 4 and 5, which is where we looked at the Russell 2000, which is the small cap index, and the NASDAQ. And what is particularly amazing about the Russell is it's been resilient. Not only did that low in March not go all the way back down to the February lows, but it wound up in this channel and has decisively broken. I mean, the Russell is pretty much at 52-week highs, and we haven't broken yet to a higher high. But the fact that we already see the Russell winding up, ready to break out to fresh new 52-week highs, is showing that there is bullishness in the markets here.
Okay, so we're seeing lots of resilience in the small cap stocks in the Russell 2000. Now, what about the technology stocks, which are represented by the NASDAQ?
Well, I have on page 5 the NASDAQ 100. Now, it's a very interesting chart because, first of all, the March highs actually made higher highs than that January high that came in. And so the NASDAQ already diverged a little bit by making higher highs after that big drop in February. But what's interesting here is that the market correction, very similar to the Russell, kind of traded all the way back down, but never going back to the February lows, wound up. And the breakout we have here, even though has not reached the March highs, we're already trading just a stone's throw away from that 7,000 level, which was the highs that came in January that marked the highs both in the Russell and the S&P 500 and the Dow. And so we are seeing some pretty interesting strength in the NASDAQ and in the Russell. And it's sort of telling a story that is a little more bullish than when we're looking just at the S&P 500.
Okay, so it seems like, you know, all the stars are in alignment now. We thought that there was a possibility of an upside resolution to this triangle. I was a little bit surprised we didn't get one more push lower, but we were ready for this. We've gotten the signal that the upside is happening. Now, is there anything that you're seeing that would tell you this could be a false breakout? Is there any level we need to get above before you feel that there's confirmation that the rally is on? Or do you think that we're seeing a signal here, which is maybe a buy signal for a summer rally?
There isn't a technical reason for me to really believe that this is not going to happen. But what is really interesting is the cross current, because you really have a huge amount of headlines coming out that seem so bearish on the surface. Like there was a headline about Ray Dalio and Bridgewater or Dan Loeb at Third Point increasing their short books and reducing their net longs. And it seems almost to feel like counterintuitive to be bullish or long the market when some of the biggest money players the headlines seem to be coming out so bearish. But I think that there's still room here for these cross currents to be a tail between the short-term path of the markets versus the big longer-term outlooks. Because I do still believe generally that this is going to become a big topping formation for the top of the bull market and subsequently a bear market on the other side. And so, you know, it really is about what is the short-term path. And I think a short-term path for a summer rally is still the path of least resistance here for the markets.
Okay, Patrick. Well, that's very much consistent with my overall view. I had expected that we were likely going to see one more push lower. Looks like maybe that's not happening. But in the grand scheme of things, what I was looking for was some kind of retrace, probably back to at least a retest of the prior high, maybe new all-time highs. But as you say, part of a topping formation. It's not over quite yet, but you know, we're in the ninth inning here in terms of this equity market. And I do think that there's reason for long-term significant concern, but it doesn't mean that the final top is in quite yet. Speaking of tops, I want to come back to a subject that's very much near and dear to my heart, which is crude oil. My analysis in this environment is, hey, you know, right now, upside momentum is controlling this market, and it's, I think, driven by a lot of geopolitical fear. And I guess my question to you as the technician is, okay, if fear is driving a strong uptrend, how far can it go? Because it feels to me like it's going to go and hit a top, and maybe there's going to be a pretty darn sharp correction after that top is in. I'm just not sure where the top would be.
Well, you know, I did a couple of measured moves that measured out technically some of the upper targets of crude oil. There's a number of shorter measured moves that all converge around that 74, 75 level. And I think that's a very reasonable, multi-week target that we can have, even a multi-day target if momentum that started a few days ago continues. But there is a longer measured move from when you take that September to January rally, it measures as high as that 78, 79, and potentially the round number $80 level on the upper end. Now, whether we see it, that's something we'll find out in the coming weeks. But I think it's reasonable at this stage to, if the momentum remains here in oil, to target those upper levels. I mean, at some stage, I completely agree with you, fading crude oil off the top, especially when there's a de-escalation of the geopolitical element, is going to offer up a pretty compelling crude oil short. But the question is, do we get an opportunity to do it off of higher levels?
Yeah, and I have a feeling that we will. You know, the way that I see this market right now is there's very strong upside momentum. It could be ending, but, you know, I don't feel like it's ending quite yet. The thing you have to remember, though, is we already had such an insanely lopsided speculative positioning. Patrick, this rally is just going to embolden the longs to get even longer. So we're probably going to get to new all-time records in net speculative long open interest in crude oil futures. It's a setup for a dramatic downside reversal at some point. I don't think we're at that point yet. I think we've got a ways to go to the upside. But watch out when we get there, especially if you have the combination of a geopolitical de-escalation. And if at the same time you get a couple of bearish inventory surprises, wow, that could trigger the unwind of this massive speculative long position. And, you know, even if the overall trend is still going to be up, if we get a forced liquidation of that very, very, very lopsided positioning that exists on the long side of crude oil futures, it could get ugly fast. As I say, I don't think we're there yet.
All right, Eric, but I wanted to just actually ask you a question. We put a chart up on page 7, and we've in the past shows have touched upon the crude oil term structure many times, and we haven't touched on it for, it seems, many months since we last looked at it. And what was really interesting to me was I remember back in the 2007, 2008, 2009 period, there was a substantial backwardation when oil was ripping up to like the 140-plus area when it was back in 2008. And we're seeing that kind of huge backwardation in the oil market today. And I don't know fully how to understand it, but I was hoping that you can kind of give us some insights on what's going on here on the term structure chart.
Well, certainly we've had a massive, massive increase of backwardation since the last time we looked at this chart. And as we pulled this one up, something I couldn't help but notice immediately, our long-term listeners may recall when we were, let's say, at $52, $53 on front-month oil prices, I was observing, hey, look at this, guys. You know, the price is all the way up here at $53, of course, all the way up at $53. It had been in the 40s a few weeks before that. And I said, you know, I find it interesting that as it moves up and down and fluctuates at the front end of the curve, the back end of the curve is staying glued right on $50, as if that's the magic number that the shale guys can hedge at successfully. And, you know, the back of the curve just stays anchored to $50, even when we're all the way up at $53 or $54 in the front month. Well, guess what? Now we're all the way up at $71 and change on the front month. Where's the back of the curve? $50, actually $52. It's moved up $1.50 since then. So we still see the back of the curve, you know, right down at that same level. It's further out. You have to get all the way out to 2024 to find those prices below $52. But they're there. And if you look at the growth of backwardation, yeah, we just saw a few days ago, we had both the UV spread, as it's known to traders, which means the September to October spread, as well as the August to September spread, or the QU spread. They both went over 70 cents, so more than 70 cents in a single month of backwardation in the period between August and October. So we're seeing increased backwardation. Now, the theory of this is what backwardation tells you is an expectation of tightening in the crude oil market, which seems a little backwards because you think, well, if things are tightening, doesn't that mean that the price is going up? And doesn't that mean that if we're expecting the market to tighten in the future, that the forward curve should be pricing things in contango? Well, it actually tends to work the other way. What will happen when crude oil markets get tighter is the immediate delivery price starts to trade at a greater and greater premium to longer dated contracts. That's called backwardation. So what we see in this steepening term structure is actually an expectation of market tightening. Now, a lot of analysts are saying this has gone as far as it can go, and it's about to reverse in the other direction. The thing is, they've said that about 8 times now in the development of this growth of backwardation, and it's continuing. We saw this back in the 2012-2013 timeframe, and these trends of backwardation and contango tend to take years to play out. So it seems that we're seeing strengthening backwardation across the curve. It's even stronger in the Brent market, and I think it's likely to continue. But Patrick, I want to change the subject because you're doing a freebie for Macro Voices listeners. Normally, your big picture trading webinars are something you have to pay for. You're doing a free one as a courtesy to Macro Voices listeners. So I really want to thank you on behalf of Macro Voices for doing that. Tell us what you have planned.
I put together a presentation exploring the option strategies that Warren Buffett uses to profit. He's done an array of different options trades throughout his career, which I'm going to be discussing in detail. But one of the biggest, of course, is his sale of long-dated index puts that netted him $4.9 billion in premium. But what was most interesting about what he did was he started his selling in 2007, right before the great financial crisis, and he held right through it. So how did that trade turn out for him? How did he manage the position? What was he doing throughout that whole period? I go through a presentation kind of covering all of that. So I'm doing that webinar on Sunday, May 13th at 10 a.m. New York time. And the link is in the Research Roundup email as well. You can just go to bigpicturetrading.com and register for it.
Now, I just want to put that in perspective and make sure I understand it, Patrick, because you said put writing strategy. So you're telling me that Warren Buffett wrote puts. That means he's selling insurance that allows people to cash in if the market goes down. He sold that insurance right at the top of the market in 2007 and managed to make money on the trade anyway, even though the market did go down. You know, intuitively, you would think that the buyers of those puts, that the puts would have moved into the money and he would have lost a fortune, would have lost everything. You're saying he made a profit on that. Is that right?
Oh, he did. And some of those options are actually still open today. And so we can't officially say he's made a fortune because he's still open on them. First of all, to just add clarification is that they are index options, which are European settlement, which don't have that feature of being able to be exercised at any stage. But it is still a really interesting story, and I'm going to go through it in the webinar.
Well, Patrick, I strongly encourage our listeners to check that out. Something I found fascinating last time you did this, we were getting emails saying people really love your options coverage in the post-game segments and we should do more of it. Okay, so people want more Patrick, more content from Patrick. And then, you know, we had something like 25,000 downloads from that episode in terms of listeners. Only 300 or 400 of them signed up for your webinar. This is a free one, folks. Hope you get the message. If you want to be like Warren Buffett, you got to understand value. Whether or not it makes sense for you to sign up at Big Picture Trading so you get this stuff all the time, that's your own personal decision. Whether or not it makes sense to take advantage of good stuff free, Warren Buffett, you know what he would say.
Absolutely. Well, listen, it's a great story. I'm looking forward to sharing that with all of our listeners. So we'll see many of you on Sunday, and it'll be a great show. Otherwise, Eric, any last closing words?
You know, I think that wraps it up, but you've heard it before. You'll hear it again. We need your help promoting Macro Voices, folks, because the more registered users we have, the more able Patrick is to negotiate to get us the very best feature interview guests. So please forward your research roundup emails, tell your friends and colleagues about Macro Voices, and most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our research roundup emails each week, which never contain any advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all of the best research that we could find on the internet, as well as downloads for things like today's post-game chart book, as well as downloads from our feature interview guests. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's research roundup.
All right. Well, this week you're going to find that transcript for today's interview with Charles. You'll also find that chart book that me and you discussed in the post game. There's a link to a number of the GavCal articles that were discussed throughout the interview. But there's also an interesting article highlighting the double line webcast where Jeffrey Gundlach asked that important question of, is there a recession coming? So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners. And we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.